Hello and welcome to IPO Stories, a podcast that explores the tracks to IPOs for companies and their stakeholders.
Through interviews with professionals who have led companies to public markets, we will learn about what it takes to IPO a business, the do's and the don'ts before, during, and after a listing process. I'm Gauthier.
I'm Per, co-founders of Omniscient Investment Management, a Europe-based equity manager. Not all IPO processes end up with an IPO. Today we will talk with Maria Hedengren, who was the CFO of iSettle, a Swedish payments company, at the moment of their IPO in 2018. The process ended with PayPal acquiring the company the day before the publication of the prospectus, for double the planned IPO price. Maria has been through two IPO processes, first as the CFO of iSettle in 2018, and then as the CEO of Readly in 2020. Before iSettle, she was the CFO of NetEnt, a listed company, for 5 years. She is now the founder of Oxygen First, an independent advisor to startups and scale-ups, a venture partner at the VC firm 8Roads, and a board member for several companies. With Maria, we discuss her experience running the IPO processes of iSettle and Readly, and the lessons from those processes, in particular how the management should take ownership of the process leading up to the IPO. Before we start, we would like to remind our listeners that our discussion is not financial advice, nor an investment recommendation, nor a solicitation to buy or sell any financial instruments, or an offer for financial services or any other transaction. The information contained in the recording has no contractual value and are destined for an informational purpose only. Omniscient Investment Management and the participants in this podcast may have holdings in the companies being discussed. Maria, thank you very much for joining today. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Looking forward to this. Yes, I am living in Stockholm. I'm Swedish, and this is my base since many years. I started out in finance, so I'm a finance professional for about 25 years, and then my last operational job was CEO, and it's been tech and IT throughout my career. I never became sector specific, but very common thread has been growing or changing or both. Tech companies often disrupting or revolutionizing analog tradition into a digital world and growing and expanding internationally for many years. I was the CFO of iSettle, for example, which I think we're going to touch on today, and when we were supposed to IPO it, and then ended up selling it to PayPal. And then I was the CEO of Readly, which I IPO'd, which I think we're also going to cover today. And now, since a couple of years back, I am a so-called pluralist. So I share my time between a number of board jobs on different companies on the one hand, and on the other hand, I'm also engaged in the venture capital scene. So I am a venture partner at 8Roads venture capital firm based out of London, and I do startup investments and supporting entrepreneurs and having the time of my life. I have two kids, teenagers, and that's interesting time as well. And a dog.
Excellent. And it's interesting, this the Stockholm tech scene has really been very strong actually over throughout your career, right?
Yes, for sure.
Across both payments, but also in Spotify. And there's been quite a lot of value creation in the tech space there.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, if we talk about iSettle, so you said you were the CFO. And it was quite a unique IPO experience in 2018, right? Because you had an IPO process that was very engaged and very well engaged, and that ended up in a strategic exit in just a few weeks' time, I think.
Yes, it was the IPO of the year, they said. Even if we're a small little Swedish country, it was very in the spotlight, and a lot of investors globally, actually, they were very interested. And I think I stopped counting around 300 investors, both on the West Coast and the Midwest and the East Coast in the US, and then throughout Europe and in Sweden. So it was a very sought after IPO. And then we ended up not IPOing after all.
If we step back, what was the background story of the founding of iSettle and its development?
iSettle was born out of great frustration, as many of these successful tech companies are. It was a frustration over how difficult and expensive it was and ridiculously hard for sole entrepreneurs, sole business owners to be able to accept credit card. And as you know, Sweden and probably all of Scandinavia are very early adopters when it comes to paying with cards and really not carrying any cash at all. I don't remember last time I carried cash. And it has been like that for quite a long time. So it's very hard for small business owners to be able to get paid when they're on these big conferences or wherever they are. And so the founder, Jakob De Geer, he tried to help his wife to get some kind of solution for credit card payment. And she only needed it for about four times a year. So it was not a good business case for her to get this big bank type of, you know, this huge terminals and stuff, very expensive. And so he met his co-founder, Magnus Nilsson, and they decided to do something about it. And the result was iSettle.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's a very similar story actually to Wise, right? Where Wise was also born out of the frustration of transferring money between countries, and I guess maybe more in a personal capacity than in a business capacity.
Yeah.
In terms of disruption, what was the big disruption of iSettle? Was it the cost or was it the onboarding or...
It was a lot of things. So you could actually accept credit cards using your mobile phone and a card adapter in the beginning. And then we ended up getting a small, what you call a terminal, that was like, I don't know, fifth size of a traditional terminal or even smaller. And there were several aspects. One thing was the cost. It was and still is very expensive to get credit card terminal, a larger system. There's also, you know, the process of getting onboarded. It takes a long time and to be approved. And the other thing was not just the cost and the ease of use and being able to carry it around. It's also associated with a very nice, sleek point of sale system on your mobile or on your iPad. You didn't need a big cashier thingy standing, you know, on the desk. So all the equipment was a lot modern, but also easier and less expensive. And just small thing as the design, it was very nice looking and very small. But I think overall, it just made life so much easier for sole business owners or small businesses in terms of cost and ease of use and being mobile, being able to carry that around with them if they were in different locations, etc.
So I guess iSettle actually leveraged, again, the iPhone revolution, basically, right?
Yes.
Around the 2010s and built on that to create a simpler and more efficient payment terminal in a way.
Yeah.
In terms of markets, at the time of IPO, was it already a global customer base or how was that?
Yes, we were in many of the European countries and also in Mexico and Brazil. I don't remember, it was around 10, 12 markets at that time.
Now, you joined iSettle in December 2016. When you joined, you came with quite a lot of listed company experience, right? From being the CFO of NetEnt and actually also CFO of a listed company before that. So you had a long experience. But was an IPO already on the cards then when you joined?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you never know if an IPO was going to happen or not. That was a clear strategy that they have. And it was sort of an outspoken goal for me.
How much time did the IPO preparation period last, in a way?
It was around 1.5 years. It started pretty much the day I walked into the door. And then it ended up in, I can't remember now, I think it was May in 2018, that we were just about to ring the bell. The prospectus was finished and we were going on the final week of roadshows. So yeah, about 1.5 years.
And during that period, was there a lot of preparation that needed to be done on the company before you could actually sort of launch the bankers, et cetera, on it? Was the company already in a shape that you as CFO could underwrite for the IPO? Was there a lot of pre-preparation there?
No, I think iSettle was a well-managed company. But having said that, I think few companies are IPO ready. And it was a very sort of entrepreneurial-driven company, very agile and well managed. But when you are going to do IPO, there's just so much more from the composition of the board that you need a number of independent board members. For example, you can't just have owner representatives. You have to have an audit committee and everything. And then all the way down to actually, you know, the routines for checking in and checking out code, because there is a lot of IT processes and internal controls. They're called IT general controls. So if you're not already ISO certified, for example, then you have to really go through the entire organization from the tech department to the treasury department to the board to pretty much everything. And you have to talk to the marketing and communications team, you know, about inside the regulation. And you have to train the entire company. So it's very pervasive. And in all of this, you need to try and find a balance to maintain an agility, a certain pace, and certain culture that you don't become this like huge wet blanket over the entire business just to adhere to the requirements.
You said that the IPO preparation started the moment you walked in the door. What was the first thing you did then? What was the first actions in order to make the company IPO ready?
As far as I remember, it was talking to the founders about the board composition and saying that we need to look at the board. We had a number of observers, you know, I mean, you know what that is. I mean, it's people who have the right, according to a shareholders agreement, to participate on behalf of shareholders, but they're not formal board members. You can't have that when you get near to an IPO. And then you need a certain number of independent board members. So we started the search process and to also anchor with the owners and the observers that at some point they had to exit the boardroom. And we also looked at what kind of cornerstones investors would like to have and to do a pre-IPO fundraising. So we did brought on a number of institutional shareholders like Swedish pension funds. So there was a lot of that type of activity early on.
And in the pre-IPO round, you actually did that quite early then. That was about a year before the planned IPO?
Yeah.
What was the goal of that pre-IPO round then? Was it to have enough working capital or was it to de-risk the IPO transaction? How did you think about that?
I think it's both. Having people on board already is, of course, less risk and brings a lot of credibility. But we were also wanting to ensure we had enough working capital to continue to grow during this time. And also, you never know exactly when the IPO is going to happen. So you need headroom and a solid balance sheet.
Now, you had already been the CFO of NetEnt, as I mentioned. Do you think it's important to have a CFO with listed company experience before the IPO?
I do. And I'm not saying it's impossible if you have a CFO that doesn't have that experience, but I think it's so much easier. Maybe you don't have to have been doing an actual IPO. iSettle was my first IPO, but I had genuine experience from being CFO of a listed company. And there is so many things that you ideally should have as a backbone reflex in terms of the sort of general quality of processes and output that you need to have, the type of internal controls you need to have to live up to regulation and expectation on external communication. And also, how do you handle investor meetings? What does the insider regulation say? There are so many things around that. And I think it's hard to both do an IPO and actually never been subject to those kind of requirements at all.
No, definitely the communication with investors, I think, is quite different between a listed company and a privately owned company because it's very regulated. But at the same time, you have to be quite consistent in communicating all the time and not just when you're raising capital, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's about being able to look a little bit around the corner, consequences of different paths and decisions. And it's hard to do that if you've never been around that corner before.
In 2018, how did you actually decide that it was the right time to move forward? You had been preparing for the IPO for about a year and during all of 2017, what was the trigger to say, we're ready, we're going for it for May 2018 in this case?
I mean, it's always a conversation with the banks and it's a lot about the market sentiment, what other companies are in the pipeline. You know, what are the experiences of IPOs earlier that year? You know, how does it fit? You don't want to go, there are certain months to become intense. It's like May or early June, if you go on Q2, for example, because you don't want people to be on holiday, etc. So it's all about market sentiment and are you optimizing your attention and who came before you and who do you think is going to come after to optimize your position?
Was the listing location, was that a discussion you had? Because you're planning to list in Stockholm, but you could also have listed in the US, I guess, as a tech company, or even a number of your peers who actually listed in France between Agenico and Worldline, sort of the older school payments companies. Was this a discussion or was Stockholm the go-to market from the beginning?
It was not a heavy debate, but it was definitely a topic of discussion. It had to be. I think for us, it was about both size So we talked about London, for example, but we would have been become quite a small player there. And if you look at sort of the demographics of the London Stock Exchange and then US tech company, but we did not have any customers in the US. So we didn't really see that we were in the public eye. People didn't really know about us. There was no really, would we get the right sort of attention among investors? And, you know, Stockholm is a good exchange. So we felt it was natural for us to IPO in our home sort of turf.
I think I completely agree about the not having any customers in the US because, again, there's a question of brand recognition, right? That helps you post-listing. But if you're not known, then I know about iSettle because I lived in Norway and I've used it a number of times. A US fund manager would maybe not have been that knowledgeable about the company. But in Stockholm, I guess you didn't really have any direct payments peers listed there, but still you had a number of tech companies. Was that what was sort of used as the comparables or how did you set that up?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We had to do a lot of education. I think, you know, I'm not sure we would have to take a different decision on what market to IPO in, but it was definitely a challenge that the analysts in Sweden, in Swedish banks, weren't used to looking at payments companies. So to some extent, they looked at Swedish tech companies, but even more had to educate themselves and we had to educate them around the global payments landscape. So, you can't just look at normal tech companies for a payments company, I think.
And now PayPal, that's an international payments company. When did they actually show interest? Was this something that came early or late in the process?
My understanding is that people talk to each other in the industry. So it's not that PayPal had never met Magnus or Jacob or talked to the company before. So they were sort of at some level familiar with each other. But when they actually approached us to start this dialogue of acquiring us, that was around the time we ITF'd. So ITF is a press release when, with your intention to float. And then if there is anybody who have been sort of thinking about you for a while, that's when they come out with the woodworks because they know that it's so much harder to acquire a company once it's listed. You can't really control the price or, you know, the shareholders at that time. So I think that's when they said it's now or never. And the intense negotiations and due diligence and so on was pretty much from that time, I would say, which was around, 4 weeks before.
And how did you organize that process that became a dual track process? It wasn't that initially, but how did you kind of organize it between the strategic and...
The iSettle IPO was a very heavy IPO. We had 6 banks, 4 law firms. We were doing an 144A offering in the US. So everything became so much more complex and we traveled a lot. So we were fortunate to have 2 founders, Magnus and Jacob, and it was me. And then there was other people in the organization, a man who was actually a former CFO who had become a CEO once I joined. So we could create 2 parallel teams. And then, of course, we kept helping each other and discussing together. But, you know, we could sort of run in parallel. So Jacob and I were on the road meeting tons of investors and dealing with that process and the banks. And then we had this other internal team who were in the trenches with the PayPal.
And how did you feel that the due diligence process from a strategic acquirer was different from what maybe public investors would expect? Because I guess they would ask for different information or they could have a somewhat different due diligence approach.
I don't know if you can compare this process to any normal sort of DD process because they had a very short period of time. But I also think the fact that they knew we'd gone through the IPO readiness process and had been approved by the IPO listing auditors who had given us a really good report and recommendation, that was probably one of the reasons why they even dared to approach us because, you know, big US company, they wanted to make sure we didn't have any skeletons in the closet. So, I mean, they looked at the prospectus, for example, and they spent a lot of time on the IT environment, making sure it was solid and couldn't be penetrated. But it was pretty much, I don't know, 20 Americans in a conference room at the lawyer. That's how they did their due diligence pretty much. I don't think you can compare that to a lot of other due diligence processes. They had to take a bet or two.
It's true what you're saying, that doing due diligence on an IPO-ready company is probably much easier than doing due diligence on a tech company that's taken sort of some venture funding over time, because the audit standards aren't the same. The accounting has probably been completely revamped. And so it's probably an easier process. What ultimately decided you and the owners to go for the strategic exit? And what were the pros and cons between IPO, staying independent, and basically charting your own path and becoming part of PayPal?
There were clear advantages of the strategic route with PayPal. I mean, besides the obvious fact that they were paying almost double the valuation compared to if we were IPOing. It was not just about that. It was cultural fit. If you could ever have a cultural fit between a US company and a Swedish company, but as good as it gets, I guess. And they had a very similar purpose and vision, like, why are we doing it? What's our role? And how do we support, you know, the merchants? So it was a good cultural fit and there was almost no overlap in terms of product and market. So there was very good opportunities for cross-selling and creating that, say, 1 + 1 = 3 instead of 2 or even more. So I think that all the sort of textbook things you need to look at when you consider the M&A path was there. Of course, valuation was a big part of it as well.
2x the IPO price is definitely, I guess, a price that none of the IPO investors would have been ready to pay, at least at that time. But maybe a few years later, it would have been valued at that price. After I settled, you joined Readly in April 2019, so 5 years ago. Were you hired there to run the IPO process again, or was that something that came after you joined?
I think that was one of the potential exit routes. It was the largest venture capital owner of iSettle that was also the largest venture capital owner of Readly. And they had been in the company for over 5 years at that time. I think when we exited, it was their 7th year or something. So it was...
Which investor was that?
Souk Capital with a Z, a clean tech fund based out of London. And so, of course, they needed to look at exit strategies. But you never know, there could be different options for them as well. So I think they brought me on board partly because of that experience, but I became the CEO. So I think they also saw that I had great experience to also lead the company if we didn't IPO. So the first thing I had to do was to recruit a new CFO because they didn't have a suitable CFO at that time. So.
And given your experience now with iSettle, what decisions did you make differently once you had joined Readly?
I'm not sure we made different decisions, but I think we could be more proactive and sort of set the agenda and our sort of wishes and establish that quite early on and take more control of the whole process. It was a smaller IPO, but still big enough to have 2 banks at least instead of 6. So I think it was more the execution was a bit smoother and a bit more proactively managed by us than doing anything really different.
And how did you decide on sort of the right banks and advisors to use, given the slightly different profile of the company? As you're saying, it was slightly smaller, but still a sort of Swedish tech company. What were the considerations there to run that?
I mean, it's always a puzzle. Right. So it's about coverage. It's about investors. It's about other IPOs. It's also a lot about the analysts. You know, what kind of do they have analysts that we think are doing a good job and that know the sector well? Are they also looking at our comps, which helps in terms of getting a fair valuation and reporting after? And it's also about the team. It's all of those things. And then getting banks that complement each other. So. I said that we had 2 global coordinators, which are sort of together managing the whole process, and then a number of sort of joint book runners that are more just running with the book among investors. And it really were.
Who were the global coordinators for ISET?
It was Carnegie and it was JP Morgan.
Okay. And for Readly, who did you choose there?
It was ABG was the global coordinator and it was Handelsbanken was the joint bank. And then you do tender process. And so I think no bank syndicate is necessarily right for every company.
No, I think you have to adapt it, as you're saying, especially in terms of coverage and which investors they reach. And as you're saying, sort of where I settled, it made sense to have JP Morgan on it because they have a very large coverage of global tech, right? And then you would want to have that.
Exactly.
Versus really slightly different. What aspects of the IPO process did you then decide to run your own way? What was the things that you did differently in a way?
Again, I'm not sure we did it differently. I just think that we could really very early on put our foot down on what things that matter. And some things that I, after my two IPOs that I suspect is a conversation in a lot of IPOs, is disclosure and reporting, for example. Because the banks, it's in their customers' interest, of course, that the company is an open book. But it's not necessarily in the best interest of the company for various reasons. Could be competition reasons, for example, that you don't want to share a certain amount of data because of you don't want competitors to be able to see your stats on certain things. And I think it's important that the reporting doesn't limit your decisions or that there's too much at stake. If you want to take a segment reporting, for example. So depending on the type of business you have, sometimes you may want to put the brakes or put the pedal to the metal on certain activities in different markets or on different products at different times. And if you had certain segment reporting, maybe the results will, you know, vary then between quarters in different markets in a way that's not really a factor of how a segment is performing. It's other strategic decisions, and it could send weird signals to the market and shareholders and look weird. So I think you want to minimize the impact on sort of strategic and operational decision making because you have to publish a quarterly earnings release. So that's one aspect that I think is very important, where you need to sort of fight the banks and quite hard sometimes. Another thing is like how you allocate the book, for example, and being more questioning the roadshow planning a bit more and just being more into the details, actually, of having the banks justify things and not just say yes. When you do an IPO, there is so much at stake. So as a company and the issuer, especially if you haven't been through this before, you want to de-risk the transaction, which can mean sometimes you say yes to things because you think you have to, because the banks or the lawyers or the auditors tell you you have to. Actually, sometimes you don't, but you have to fight for it a little bit. And the more of IPOs you do, the more confident you become that it's actually okay to say no to this. We're going to be okay anyway.
I think you're right. There's a lot at stake, and it's important as a management team to take ownership, because in the end, once the IPO is done, then you're there on your own, not accompanied anymore.
And the thing is that the banks, the lawyers, the auditors, I have great experience from all of them. But if you're looking at it objectively, their interest is not always aligned with the issuer, right? So they need to maximize the fees and minimize the risk, because that's what they need to do for their owners. But that also can influence what they advise you to do, because it's the best interest of their shareholders. But then on the day of IPO, or at least 6 months after when the green shoe is over and everything, you know, they're gone and they don't have to worry so much about how the share price is developing, or, you know, how complicated of internal controls process you have to live by, or what churn numbers you have to report every quarter. So that's something that the company needs to own and think again around the corner, looking around the corner. How shall we be able to live with this for years to come?
And I think what you were saying about the roadshow is important as well, because I think it's quite important as a management to make sure you actually go broad enough in terms of roadshow and meet a number of investors, even those that maybe won't invest in the IPO, because it's the first engagement to then having them follow the company and look at your results and maybe become shareholders over time. Some investors will be slower, but at least they might be the ones that are there in 2 years, right? Between sort of the being a CEO and a CFO in an IPO process, what are the main differences between those two?
I think that the most obvious one for me anyway was the workload is massive on the CFO. It's hard for the CEO, but I think the CFO is probably the one with the heaviest burden during any IPO process, because it's really, that person is really the spider in the web of a lot of things that need to come together in a very short period of time. and have to educate the entire organization and get everybody on board with changed processes and manage the banks and the lawyers and all the incoming emails, but also participate in the roadshow. So it's not that the CFO can stay at home and just focus internally on what needs to be finished. They also have to sit next to the CEO in all of the investor meetings and sometimes be on stage. But the biggest difference then is also the CEO has a lot more external facing job. Podcasts, articles, keynote speaking, being sort of out there in the public eye, raising awareness and interest in the company. I mean, I think it also varies, right? And I had been through an IPO process before, which meant maybe I was a little bit more relaxed. And I also hired a great CFO who took a lot of weight off my shoulders and other internal people that were great with legal and that could read the prospectus 1,000 times and things like that. So I think I had a great team at Readly.
What advice then would you give to those coming after you? If you look at your experience as an operator of IPOs, what advice would you give to those who are looking at doing it now?
I think the biggest advice is never underestimate the workload and bringing on extra help early on. Because I think a lot of companies probably try to do it themselves, but it can significantly impact how you manage the daily operations, because you have a company that needs to perform maybe the best it's ever had, you know, the time leading up to the IPO, and you can't lose grip of the business. But when you're on the road and you're in meetings all the time and you need to change processes and a lot of things, you need, especially the CFO, needs a bit of extra hands on deck in a way that maybe you don't need post-IPO. And as a CEO, that you feel comfortable that you have senior people on your management team that can run the daily operation and handle some crises, which always happen in a business, right? Without having to get in contact with you and have you get into every detail of every crisis on every day. Because so you have to have trust and be able to delegate to other leaders in the organization during this time.
You basically need the company to be running independently without the CEO on a day-to-day basis, right?
Yeah, and you know, I see a lot of entrepreneurial companies, startups and scale-ups, and if you're still founder-led, even if the founder didn't intend for it, they tend to become somewhat of a bottleneck sometimes, because they know everything inside out from day one. So often it's the fastest solution. It's just ask the founder what they think or how they would solve it or what to do. So I think as a founder, it doesn't happen by itself. I think you need to have a conscious strategy to consistently tell the organization, what would you do? You figure it out yourself. And then, you know, come back to me and you need to sort of foster people to dare to take decisions and find solutions without you in a very deliberate way. And some entrepreneurs have that in their backbone, maybe because they're serial entrepreneurs and know what it takes to get to that point. But if you haven't thought about it, I advise you to have a look at that.
In a way, the IPO also helps the company grow in a way, because you empower the rest of the organization.
Exactly.
You're also a board member in a number of boards, and you talked about the importance of constituting a good board quite early in the process. What do you think is important in choosing your independent board members?
I think the luxury you have with the board is you don't have to have one single person being the perfect fit for your business. You can composition a team, like with a management team. So I think it's really about looking at the owner representatives who will stay on the board long term. What would you like to complement their experience with? It can be commercial. A lot of VC partners, they are great at finance and generalist and being able to see the big picture and draw parallels with other businesses. But, you know, sometimes it can help to have a more deep commercial experience. Or if the founders aren't the techies on the team, the world is so complex now. you know, it becomes harder and harder to be a board member and do a good job. And so nowadays, you need to look at so many things like cybersecurity and AI and sustainability. And so it's just really to pull out the checklist and see the people we already have, what checkbox do we have and what we then need to get. And then you always need somebody to run the audit committee, which usually should be somebody with financial experience of a listed company to make sure to be a good prolonged arm of the board to cover the financial reporting.
When we discussed initially, you said that each IPO has a defining moment and that you remember it very vividly.
Yes.
What were the defining moments of the iSettle and the Readly processes? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah. By the way, I would love to talk to other people who've done IPOs. They agree with this, that they also had this moment that they will remember. So you remember what you were wearing, what the weather was like, and like everything. So with iSettle, it was the night we signed with PayPal. And I was actually at home. I was not in the big conference room of people because people told me, Maria, you need to go home and sleep because we're not sure we're going to sign with PayPal tonight. And then you need to be ready to do IPO tomorrow. So you go home and sleep. And obviously I wasn't sleeping. I was sitting at home in my couch and following what was going on via text message and email and on the phone. And I don't know if you remember or knew, but the news leaked before we had signed the contract. And that was because we had given embargo to Bloomberg because we wanted them to be able to release the great news, you know, very quickly. So they weren't allowed to talk, but somehow it got out, maybe not from Bloomberg, but somebody leaked somewhere. You know, we had huge team by this time, both in Sweden and in the US. So we don't know who did, but it started to become a rumor online. And then after a while, I think Bloomberg said, well, F it, you know, it's already out. We're going to release it now. So I think it was around maybe 8 o'clock that the first sort of, what the hell, you know, what's this I'm reading online? Have we signed? And we're like, no. And then I think we signed like 5 minutes past midnight or something. So there was a long window. And then you have this, it's called bring down calls. You know, it's where the banks gather all the lawyers and the key people at the company, and they run through a checklist to make sure that no serious event has happened. And are we still going? Is it still a go or is it a no-go? And I think I postponed that probably 3 times. We need another 45 minutes. We need another hour. And everybody's okay. There were like 100 people on that call. And everybody's like, where is iSettle? And then in the end, I sent text message, said we're canceling. And then Carnegie called me at 7 o'clock in the morning. He's like, Maria, what's going on? Are we going on a roadshow today? I'm like, no, sorry, we're not. So, and I remember, you know, I had my suit hanging. It would be pressed and everything that I was going to have the day after. So that was the iSettle, the defining moment. But that was like a fun, positive experience, right? I think at Readly, it was not such a fun defining moment. And that is, it was a lot in the media. Two large publishing houses that we were licensing content from. It was Aller and Bonnier, Swedish media houses. They terminated their contract with us. I think it was 3 days before we were supposed to IPO. And they did so with 90 minutes in between. It was on a Friday. And I first got a call from a chief content officer telling me about one of them. Of course, that was shocking in itself. But then I sat by my laptop. It was an overcast day. I know exactly where I was sitting. And then there is this email from a person I didn't know. And I was almost browsing past that email because I didn't know the sender and like, some sales person, what is this? And then I'm like, read the subject. I'm like, what the hell is this? And then I opened the email and then it was the other publisher saying, we hereby notify you that we're terminating our contract. Time stood still. I'm like, what the hell am I going to do now? I think it was a lot of in the news and it was hard, but we were still 11 times oversubscribed on the IPO. We pushed it a couple of days and we spent a lot of time during the weekend to talk to the cornerstone investors and having them ask us all the questions they needed. And we put a lot of sort of data to explain to them that these two publishing houses, although they were very well known in Sweden, Sweden wasn't even our largest market at that time. Germany was. but it looks really bad. In Sweden was the place where we're going to IPO, and everybody thought that, you know, now we're going to go under, which we didn't. And so it was a lot of work, and I think we did a great job of explaining that to everybody. But I was tough.
I think those are both great defining moments. Thank you very much for sharing them. And thank you very much, Maria, for joining us today and sharing your insights. Thank you for listening to IPO Stories. In future episodes, we will host CEOs, CFOs, advisors, and other participants in the IPO process to learn from their experience, like from Maria today. If you like the show, please follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and share the show with people around you. If you have questions about the IPO process that you'd like us to address with future guests, please get in touch at contact@ipostories.com.